kickoff, with the first of two shows to mark 40 years since the dawn of the teeny bopper. Welcome to I Was a Teenage Heartthrob.
Could it be forever? Or is my mind just rambling on? I touched you once, I kissed you once, now I feel like you're mine.
Well, I feel like you're mine, and seeing your face, I'm not wrong to have these feelings. Well, I feel like you're mine, I've never known a time before.
That's it, so many meanings.
Over the next two evenings on Radio 2, I'll be looking back to the days when Britain was in the grip of teen pop mania. When David Cassidy and Donny Osmond came to the UK for the first time and sent their fans, and especially teenage girls, absolutely crazy. David and Donny were the Justin Bieber of their day, literally the pin-up boys of pop. And I know, because I was publishing those pin-ups. Back then, I was the editor of Jackie magazine, which became the Bible for teenage girls eager for stories and posters of their new idols. I interviewed and travelled with the teeny bop stars, so now I've reunited with them to find out what they remember about those times and how their careers and their lives developed over the following 40 years. So, tonight's star. Well, let's have an intro to him from the era when the BBC was still struggling with the terminology.
If you're a weenie bopper, you've probably heard had his poster on your bedroom wall at some point in the last year or two, and you may have seen his TV program, The Partridge Family. He is, of course, David Cassidy.
My conversation with David tonight, the upside of being a pop idol.
Imagine one person looking at you from 100 feet away, screaming at you, I love you, I love you, I love you. Now do that times 70,000.
And the downside.
I got in a relationship that was very self-destructive.
How a Beatle became his mentor.
There were very few people who really could understand it, but John Lennon certainly did, and we talked a lot about it.
And his reaction when I played him a message he recorded all those years ago for the Raiders of Jackie.
I listened to a 22-year-old David Cassidy, and it's really interesting. Kind of emotional.
In April 1972, in this country, you released a single called Could It Be Forever?
Yes, I did.
It was your first solo hit single, and it's practically been forever because it's 40 years.
Yes.
And here you are.
It was a double A-side, and here I am. And my fans are just the most dedicated, most incredibly passionate. I don't know. It's just been a unique connection and love affair, really, for me.
So, David, I want to take you back to Wembley Stadium.
50,000 teeny boppers paid £60,000 to see a 22-year-old called David Cassidy give six concerts in 48 hours, a performance that produced signs of hysteria not seen since the Beatles hit the road 10 years ago.
David, what feelings do those sounds bring back to you, do they?
Well, I told you we had a special connection, didn't I? That was pretty special, and it was hysterical, and it was dangerous for them more than for me. I had adequate security. It was very reminiscent of Beatlemania in America. And John said to me, Lennon said to me, you know, it's always different because you're American, you go to the UK. I mean, it's not that they don't love us in Britain. They do. But it's because they know that you're going to leave and that you won't be coming back and you may never come back. And I've had fans say, no, but now you belong to us. And I feel like I've always belonged here as my second home in Britain. And I didn't come back and work. I left and only worked in America. I didn't work for many years anyway. And it was a decision. had to make, and there were very few people who really could understand it, but John Lennon certainly did, and we talked a lot about it. He was very much like a mentor to me.
Take that in this country.
That's right.
And they have got daughters who love Justin Bieber.
Right.
And yet your fans are still loyal. So the extraordinary thing is that you were 22 years old. Mm-hmm. You were already a star from the Partridge Family in the States. But when you were 22 years old and 40 years ago,
it
exploded here.
My life changed forever when I said yes, and I'll sign the contract to do the Partridge Family. And that really launched me around the world. And I was the first person that, I guess because of the time and because the way the stars aligned, I could sing and play and had a background from my early days, my whole family in music. I was always playing guitar. And because the Beatles in America came over and did the Ed Sullivan Show, I went out and bought an electric guitar, and I was 13 years old. I just continued to play and became a big music fan. And I pursued my career as an actor, though. I had no intention of trying to become a professional musician. Had I not landed the role of Keith in the Partridge Family, that never would have happened. And my first record in America was I Think I Love You, which was the record of the year, which, ironically, 1970, largest, biggest selling record. It was the last record that the Beatles put out, which was Let It Be. And to outsell the Beatles for me was really a contradiction.
It must be really weird.
It was weird, and I felt somehow or another wrong about it, even though I loved the song. It was a great record. I mean, Let It Be was as well.
I'm sleeping and right in the middle of a good dream, like all at once I wake up from something that keeps knocking at my brain. Before I go insane, I hold my pillow to my head and spring up in my bed, screaming out the words I dread. I think I love you. This morning I woke up with this feeling I didn't know how to deal with, and so I just decided to myself I'd hide it to myself and never talk about it, and did not go and shout it when you walked into the room. I think I love you.
Paul once, and got to play with John a few times, and really become friends with him, and he taught me a lot about where life for me would be going, and basically was kind of a guide. He and I referred to, well, he referred to it as becoming a house husband and then trying to demystify himself so he could walk down the street. And at that time, I couldn't. And he said, well, the first couple of years are a little rough. And he said, it takes a while to feel comfortable walking down the street because you couldn't do it for so long.
Because I, at the time, was with Jackie Magazine, mm-hmm. which has since become legendary. Mm. And you were such a gift to us.
I
know that. Everybody
told me that. Jackie was it. And for fans there.
When I first saw you, you probably won't even remember that you were used as a role model for the Keep Scotland Tidy campaign.
Keep Britain Tidy.
It began as
Keep Scotland Tidy, but in the end, I became the person they asked me if I would do. They didn't pay me. If I would just try and be a positive role model to keep Britain tidy. And I said, of course I will. So they gave me a t-shirt, I put it on, they took a couple of photographs, and the next time I came back, I don't know when it was exactly, 73 or something maybe, but I was all over these billboards and posters all over.
Yeah, they were
everywhere.
The
interesting thing now is that an artist would ask for £2 million, you know. I didn't ask for a nickel. It wasn't about money, it was the right thing to do. You know, they actually asked me at one point, because we know you love to drink tea, would you just be the spokesperson for British Tea? And I said, sure. And my manager stepped in and went, wait a minute. We've already done that one. We've done this one. Don't you think you should pay him? You know, I became a thing. Fans came to see my concert, but really what it was a media event for all of the media to take notice and put me on the cover of all the newspapers so they could make money.
When I picked a picture of you to put as a poster, or when I watched you in concert, I knew exactly what they were. And I'm going to embarrass both of us.
I'm embarrassed now. No, but that's fine.
I once stood in the wings watching you performing on stage, and you were wearing like your white Elvis-type jumpsuit.
Yeah, the same guy that made Elvis has made
Absolutely.
Mine.
Absolutely. And so, and there were the fans out the front getting this fabulous view, and I was standing in the wings watching you, and my goodness, did I have a great view. You are a fabulous mover.
Thank
you're
you.
A fantastic mover. And the other thing was, you know, the quality of your voice. You have a lovely voice, a very distinctive, unique voice, mm-hmm. but it has that breathy quality which
right.
appealed to women.
I think it appealed to everyone. My father had the same.
Yep.
He had a bigger voice than I at the time, although my voice is much bigger now, and it's from having to sing night after night, doing 10 shows a week, doing 8 shows a week, where you bang on your voice.
When you were playing Vegas.
Yeah, and I was on Broadway when I did the West End in Vegas for 6 years. I did over 2,000 shows, and in Vegas, it's so dry. I never changed a key in anything, still today. I take pride in that because it's, you know, it's sad when people lose it. I've given everything I have in my body to every show I've ever done, and I always will. My dad instilled that work ethic in me, and I don't know. For me, it's probably more, I don't know, sense of pride, sense of ego. I'd be embarrassed if I didn't give it my best. I don't know how people don't. I don't know how you live with yourself.
No.
You know, for me, it's what an extraordinary exchange you get to have with people that know all of your music, know everything about you, love you, and scream it at you. To stand at the focal point of 73,000 people and be at the focal point in that full voice, 73,000 people all pointing towards you and screaming, I love you, is so overwhelming. It's so powerful. I don't care if it's 1,000 people. Imagine one person looking at you from 100 feet away, screaming at you, I love you, I love you, I love you. Now, do that times 70,000. You can't imagine the emotion. I've often said I wish every human being could stand in my shoes just for 30 seconds, 10 seconds. You'd know what it's like to be loved like that unconditionally. It's so powerful.
Tell me that you're leaving. Can't believe that it's true. Girl, there's just no way we're here out here. It's
About the early mid-1970s, you're talking about a very naive time when the world was very naive. The audience was very unsophisticated. The world was. We now live in such a different time. You can't compare decades when there wasn't video, there wasn't MTV or VH1, there weren't cell phones. The world, there was no internet.
Yes, and yet they found you. There was no Twitter. And yet, wherever
I was,
how did they do it? I have no idea.
As Joanne Geffen, who's been my publicist and friend for 15 years now, said, I don't know how your fans still know things that you're going to do before I do. I said, they know before I do. Explain that one to me.
but they were always there. You were constantly surrounded.
And they still are.
Yeah.
It's incredible. They still are.
Now, here's another little snippet from the BBC archives to give you a flavour of how David's British fans would stop at nothing to get to him. He went on location for breakfast with Ed Stewart on Junior Choice, and the fans, as always, found out where he was.
Okay, jacket on for David and hat. We're just about to go out of the door, and here comes the reaction. There's David Cassidy makes his first appearance of the morning.
Don't come in the river! Don't come in the river!
How many of them tried to get over here? How many have tried?
A bunch, actually. Two or four last night tried to swim over. The police had to stop them.
Yeah? This happens every...
Okay, before they start coming, they're going to start coming in the river. Let's get in.
They are too, my God.
Fans and supporters and people that have been there for me have been so genuine and so gracious.
There are some that have actually achieved fame themselves in this country. Dawn French, she's a great fan. Have you met her?
I did, and it was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Anyway, I love Dawn French.
She's fabulous, isn't
she's
she?
She's phenomenal. And I love her.
And Alison Pearson wrote a book about you.
I Think I Love You. And apparently they're making it into a West End musical.
Fantastic.
I've heard that. Well, she said that to me. And yes. Yeah, I did the Today Show with her, and she's a great writer, I'll tell you what. And the book is, you would relate to it very well, I think. Even though you weren't of the age, you were so connected to people of that age, and Alison was, and it gave me an insight into it, what it was like to be a David Cassidy fan.
And there's then Fiona Bruce, who's one of our most respected newscasters, and she's rather what we call jolly hockey stick. She's rather dignified.
Jolly hockey stick.
Yes, slightly like that. You know, posh, very posh.
Very posh.
Tall and elegant. And I can't imagine her, but she must have been at some point one of those girls.
Maybe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Perhaps she was, but it's nice to know that you've had a positive effect. Again, when you bring light into people's lives and you read the letters and the stories from people from broken homes and how they found solace and how, it meant so much to them at a time in your life. It's, for me, it's like the Beatles, It changed my life, and it became... for me, it was musical more than sexual or romantic. It was inspirational to me. And, they changed my life in that way.
Young girls at that age are very vulnerable.
Very.
Very, very vulnerable.
Very.
And they feel alone in the world.
Yeah.
They don't know who to turn to.
A lot of boys do, too, but they do it. They relate to differently. Men and women are, Mars and Venus, very different. But emotionally, that time in people's lives, when they're young, they're teenagers becoming adults or young adults, their hormones are raging, their emotions are at the peak.
They don't know their place in the world. They don't know where they fit in. They feel that they're the only person who's going through the problems
that
they have.
That's absolutely
and
right.
And you embodied something that they could reach out
to. They felt safe with it. And the good news is it was a mutual respect, I think. For me, great respect for the age, for what their emotions were, even though I had to protect myself and protect myself from them and protect them from the experience of getting injured or getting hurt.
Absolutely.
Or, I mean, you know, mobs are very dangerous. We now know a lot more about it. And, you know, you put two people in a room, it changes from one person when you're alone. You put 20 people in a room, and then you make it 200, and you make it 2,000, and it just manifests itself that much more, and it gets that much easier to get out of control.
Did you fear for your own life? Because you must have had, you must have, I don't know, great security, but you must have had so many decoys and running in and out of
restaurants
and venues.
I feared for injury, you know, because it was so out of control. It can get claustrophobic. If there is a moment, and there were a few moments where suddenly I was pressed up against 25, 40, 50 people that were reaching at me, and they could have poked my eye out, or, you know, they just didn't know how to control.
Not intentionally, but
No. It was meant out of love. I got to touch you. I want to take a piece of you home with me. And I understood it, but at the same time, I had to be the one who... Now, stop. And I've had only a couple of moments like that, but I managed to control it. And some of the concerts I've done, it was really about pushing back and have them not hurt themselves. And they become, I've heard tapes of things. It's like, push back. That's all I kept saying. And they're going to make me leave. Don't do it.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me how not to beware. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
I was there at White City. Terrible.
It was horrible, but there was no way to control them.
No, I mean, I
had as much security as any human beings ever had.
I was out front before you started, and I looked at the crowd, and I thought, no, I'm not good with crowds, and I had a plastic laminate, so I went backstage. And I can remember the DJ, I think it was Tony Blackburn.
Probably.
Said, look, please, or everybody take two paces back, step back.
You're going to crush
back,
people in the back. Front.
And they did step back.
And they kept pulling people out.
There were all these stretches backstage.
Yeah.
It was a nightmare.
It's a nightmare for me, because all I want to do is come and sing and play.
Absolutely.
That's all I do. And it gets wacky. They don't crush them, but they rush the stage still. They still scream, but at least they listen to the songs now.
Yeah.
And now I have much more control, because it's like, no.
And they're grown up now.
Yeah. Well, as I've said, you know, the only difference is really... their voices have dropped an octave, and they now listen to the music and then scream.
And there's a bit of alcohol involved, possibly.
Yes, sometimes.
I came to one of your concerts some years ago, and my other half said to me, what can I expect? I said, well, some great performance, great songs, great voice. I said, but a lot of middle-aged women behaving rather embarrassingly.
It's great, though. You know, for them, they get to celebrate. And I've encouraged, come and celebrate it with me. If you'd like to drink, I have a couple, but don't get sloshed. You know, just be present enough to let, if you need a drink, to let it go a little bit. Fair enough. I can't. So you enjoy yourself. I enjoy myself by playing and being able to be there with you and to really to go through and celebrate the 40 years from my first number one here, which was the double to A-sided Cherish. Could It Be Forever? And then How Can I Be Sure? And, you know, Daydreamer and all the great, great songs that I was able to write and produce and record and sing.
Cherish is the word I use to describe all the feeling that I have hiding here for you inside. You don't know how many times I wish that I had told you. You don't know how many times I wish that I could hold you. You don't know how many times I wish that I could love you into someone who could cherish.
And you're listening to part one of I Was a Teenage Heartthrob on Radio 2. One of your other sort of famous fans, Emma Freud, her partner is Richard Curtis.
Oh, yes.
And in Four Weddings and a Funeral, there was that line that Hugh Grant spoke, which was, I think I love you.
No, as David Cassidy said before he left the part, I know this because I saw it probably 3 nights ago. I saw it, and I turned it on, and it was the second before he said, you know, that David Cassidy thing, which was the first single I had, which was I Think I Love You, which ironically was number one, was the biggest record of the year. It was number one in every country except here, I think.
Yes.
It was only like top 20. So the first time I arrived here, I didn't think anybody cared. And it was pandemonium. There were thousands of kids at Heathrow. But you know what's interesting? My security, my driver, my publicist and people that travel around with me go, I had no idea you had so many men, friends. They're all standing out. They're all guys that are standing out there. Well, they had all my albums. They just, because they had to sort of be cool and not because their girlfriends or their sisters or their, you know, whatever it was, wives. You know, it was like, oh, all right, I'll go see him. But secretly, you know, God, I love that song.
So many middle-aged men said to me, I always read my sister's copy of Jackie.
There you go.
One of the things we did with Jackie was we did a giveaway of a flexi disc. You know, there's a
I remember that.
And it was a promotion for your album, so there were a couple of tracks on it.
On a flexi disc.
Yeah, yeah.
The quality must have been fantastic.
And I wrote a little script for you to give a message to Jackie readers. And for some reason, I found it. I've kept it. It's 40 years old, and we managed to get a little bit off it. And here's what you say to them, just a little snatch.
Oh, wow.
Hi, this is David Cassidy, and it's really a beautiful day here in Los Angeles, where I live. So I decided to take a little time out of my regular recording schedule and make this little tape for you all. I'm presently sitting here in my music room with my trusty friend and companion, Bullseye.
Oof, wow. You can hear his voice has dropped a bit. It's 40 years later, most people's do, and I was very, I hear a naivete, and Bullseye, you know, he was my trusted friend and companion. He was on the cover with me of Dreams Are Nothing More Than Wishes with Chad Daydreamer, and it had some great songs on it. I recorded Valley High, which my dad had played for me back when I was a little boy, and the Puppy song was on it also. And from my standpoint, believe it or not, I listened to an innocent guy there. And a man that has now, 40 years on, gone through life, and it's heartbreak, it's joyous, delicious, wonderful experiences, but a very different guy. 40 years later, we're a different person than we were at 22, than we are at 42, 52, 62. I listened to a 22-year-old David Cassidy, and it's really interesting. Kind of emotional.
Do you look
really moved by that.
I am.
I think you've got tears in your eyes.
Well, I'm moved by it. It's an emotional experience to hear yourself and to remember doing it. I remember doing it. Until you reminded me, I'd completely forgotten, but it's beautiful. Thank you.
I remember April when the sun was in the sky and love was burning in your eyes. Nothing in the world could bother me, 'cause I was living in a world of ecstasy. But now you're gone, I'm just a daydreamer. I'm walking in the rain, chasing after rainbows I may never find again. Life is much too beautiful to live it all alone. Oh, how much I need someone to call my very own. Now the summer's over and I find myself alone with only memories of you. I was so in love I couldn't see, 'cause I was living in a world of make-believe. But now you're gone, I'm just a daydreamer. I'm walking in the rain, chasing after rainbows I may never find again. Life is much too beautiful to live it all alone. Oh, how much I need someone to call my very own.
Are you a happier person now?
Yes. I'm a much more complete and comfortable in my skin. And yeah, I'm a much more balanced human being. I was a guy who worked 18 hours a day, literally 7 days a week. And, you know, I can hear an exhausted guy there, but I hear someone who was lost. I hear that guy. I hear the guy who was in his dressing room or in his music room. And probably for Jackie, I did it at home with a microphone. And, you know, it's like a snippet. It's like seeing a photograph of yourself at another time, before you were ever married, before you ever a father, before you were ever on, you know, gone through heartbreak, heartache, great times, just, you know, five dogs later. But it was a time that I cherish, and I feel blessed to be able to look back and reflect upon it and say, God, how fortunate I am.
Were you lonely at the time? You must
yes.
have been, because you had no one to share things with.
No.
I mean, the Beatles had each other.
Each other.
Take
yeah.
That had each other. And
John and I talked a lot about that. He said, oh, I can't imagine going through it alone. He said, alone. All the time. At least we were, you know, constantly winding each other up. And, you know, you
joke, you could make jokes.
Yeah, looking at each other going, can you believe we're doing this? Can you believe this has happened? Remember, they struggled for years, right? In Germany and playing in the cavern, you know, trying to crack it, trying to make it. And those guys had bonded together. They traveled around the world together, and or at least on trains and in slums and in bars. And, in, you know, for me, I just went, skyrocketed. One day I was unknown. Well, I'd already been on the cover in America of the, because I'd done a lot of television before I did the Partridge Family, before I had a record released, before I ever was, an episode was ever aired of the Partridge Family. I was already the number one person getting letters, fan mail at the magazines. Eventually there was the Partridge Family magazine, the David Cassidy magazine, through the law firm publications, which were, you know, Fave and Teen Mag, all these teen magazines. I've forgotten the names of them all now, but again, that's what happens after 40 years of being an adult and being removed and walking away from it at the top.
It's one of those nights when you turn out the lights and you sit in the dark and you say to yourself, I miss her. It's one of those moods when your body broods and you conjure up her picture and kiss her. It's one of those things for the pain it brings. You say to yourself, hey, couldn't I live without it? Well, I think so. On the other hand, I doubt it. Suddenly,
charming English voice we heard at the top of the programme belonged to the esteemed BBC presenter Jack DeManio, who had David as a guest on his radio chat show in 1974. And David was remarkably candid about his relationships with women.
I don't see everybody coming up to me and saying, I love you, I love you, I love you. I've only really had one relationship with a woman that I felt that was really meaningful, and it didn't even enter into the our relationship, the fact that I was well known and the fact that I was who I am, or the fact that she was who she was. So I think that it was just on a one-to-one. It really was the only one I've ever experienced. As far as jealousy, I mean, I know what I went through when I was like 13, 14, 15 years old, and I was, you know, I mean, I was going with a girl and something in school, and she had like a pop idol or something, you know. I mean, it never really blew me away. It was always like, that person was always like a fictitious character, so I never really let it stand in my way. But I mean, people who feel, I mean, I was never a tremendously jealous person anyway, but I mean, I'm sure that a lot of them, their, you know, their masculinity is threatened, and they're, you know, here I am analyzing.
Must have been very hard for you when the one person you wanted to appreciate your success resented it. Your father somehow became very bitter about the fact that you had eclipsed what had been a very good career for him.
For him it was a good career, but he never became really famous. He became well respected by everyone. I mean, his work is brilliant, but he was never a big star, and his wife was.
That was Shirley Jones, who played your mother in the Partridge Family.
Yeah, my stepmom. Yeah, in spite of the fact that people thought she had something to do with it, but in fact, we didn't even realize it until the moment we were on the soundstage to actually do a screen test, and she was cast the night before. It's a fascinating story, and, you know, it was great that she was there, because she really dealt with the madness and the fame and the hysteria and what was going on in America, and with my people climbing over my gates, trying to get to me, trying to get on the set, trying, you know, hundreds of people outside the gate where we worked at the Columbia Ranch, and, you know, it was madness. And she was she never had the ego of most stars. Academy Award.
Unlike your father, who must have...
Oh, yeah.
But what did he actually say to you?
Well, he just went crazy, really. And it wasn't that he's... It's hard to even define. Shirley just finally said, you know, your father's... It's killing him. I said, yeah, but what can I do? I mean, I said, I know. I finally said to him, Jack, you're really not handling this. And there was a night up at my manager's that he had a couple drinks, and he started breaking furniture and screaming at me, and I just walked out. And it was the last time we actually spent any time together. It was really sad.
And then he sadly died in a very tragic accident.
Tragically in a fire, yeah. And he was drunk. And he had been in many different watering holes that evening. And it's still somewhat of a mystery how he ended up where he did. But he was in his apartment. I don't think anybody had... I know for a fact there was no foul play other than his own. He just fell asleep. And,
with a cigarette?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's very sad.
Indeed.
In the years since, have you managed to resolve
in your
head that you hadn't spoken to him?
Oh, yeah. I forgave him. He was incapable. My brothers have helped me a lot, and we've helped each other, because they experienced this madman as well. This wonderful, incredibly talented, gifted, powerful, loving, when he was right, he was the most loving, affectionate, kissing, hugging, tickling, all that stuff. And then the other side was this darkest, most evil, black, and with children. Oh, man, my mother used to say, your poor father is so sick. I remember being a little boy and going, what do you mean? It wasn't until I obviously grew up and was able to handle it. And I only wish,
You know, hindsight's always 20/20, but I forgave him as of my brothers, and we now laugh about the madness.
Good.
You know, the scars are still there. They just don't hurt as much, you know? I'm over it.
Will there come a day when you and I can say we can finally see each other? Will there come a time when we can find the time to reach out for one another?
And the aging process is hell, anyway.
It is. Listen, if you're talking about physicality, I mean, I see shots of me when I was 21, 2, 3, and they're constantly reminding me that I'm 40 years older.
You look great, by the way.
Well, thanks. I feel great.
You're just as slender.
Well, I all of that's the same, but it's very hard to be compared at any time for anyone at 62 to the way you were at 22. I don't care who it is. You're different. You've lived 4 decades.
Of course.
40 years of wear and tear in life.
Being in the sunshine, getting crinkles around your eyes.
Exactly. And I got it all over me. And
do you make the old man noises when you sit down? Because I make the old lady noises when I sit down.
What's that? That? Yeah,
A bit of that.
Well, I've got some arthritis and things, but I've gone and beaten my body up very well and beaten it up.
You look very athletic.
I am athletic. I always have been. And what I do when I perform, I always stay in... You know, I'm the same weight I've been for 30 years. I haven't changed within 5 pounds. So, I don't know...
What's the secret?
Well, I have to actually force myself to eat, believe it or not.
Oh, please.
I know. People hate me for saying
that. I hate you for that.
I know. Everybody does. And it's weird, but I have the opposite problem. I begin to lose weight. I forget to eat. And...
Oh, I wish I could catch that.
It's a problem. I weigh 140 pounds.
That's 10 stone.
Okay. That's exactly it.
Thank God you weigh more than me. Otherwise, that'd be really depressing. You weigh more, yeah.
Oh, I like it. When I was in the 70s, I was 9 stone something. In the early 70s, 9 stone something. Now I'm 10 stone.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm 140. On the nose is when I drop below that, I try and be a couple pounds over.
Yeah.
So I have a little room to work with. But I get to eat pizza and ice cream and all the stuff that people look at me and go, oh, you're... Really? You don't know it's a different problem to have. I'm better at what I do in everything in life, I think. Most everything in life, except I don't run as fast, and I'm at least intimidated because I used to, when my son was like 12 or 13, I used to run past him. And he'd look at me because he was really fast, and I'd look at him and go, yeah. And it was not until he was about 17, and we were outside, maybe 16, and we're outside, and he goes, Dad, you still think you could be? I said, come on. How many times do I have to just, you know, put you in your place? Well, I ran full out, and I couldn't get past him, and he started to nick past me. We're talking about 50, 60 yards. I turned on the jets. And the jets just weren't there anymore. It's like, okay, that's what's called losing a step. Losing 2 steps. But the truth of the matter is I do everything else better. I'm a better player. I'm a better singer. I'm a better athlete than I was when I was, you know, at my best at 16.
Didn't we have ourselves some kind of a summer? Didn't we have ourselves some kind of a time? Thank you.
Now, Beau's just turned 21.
21.
So, you must look at him and think, my goodness, when I was your age, what a different life I had.
Well, actually, yes, it was very different, but he's following and pursuing his dream. He did what I wanted him to do, which is to go to university. And he's got himself an agent now. He's in a band called The Fates, F-A-T-E-S. He's incredibly talented. He's a very good songwriter. In fact, he's just come over and written with Terry Britton, who Sue, my wife, had written with for a number of years. And what I'm most proud of is who he is as a person.
Which is the most important
thing. He's an incredible human being.
Now, Sue, you finally found happiness with her.
I did, 25 years later.
Yeah, with a couple of other marriages to start with.
Yes, one for about a minute and a half. Actually, we had a cup of tea, and then it just didn't seem to work. but I was out of my mind.
Maybe the wrong tea bags.
No, I was going through probably a very deep depression after my mom... my mom was very loving and supportive. When my dad died, it crushed my mom and it crushed me. And then my manager died. And right after that, I had gotten in a relationship that was very self-destructive. And it was just meant to be unhappy. My first marriage, we should have been friends. I love her, Kay Lenz. Wonderful actress, wonderful person. We still pass notes to one another through mutual friends, and she's great. And I'll always love and respect her as a human being. But we just were too young, and we had just both lost our fathers, and like within months of each other. And it was like not really meant to be more than a bonding friendship, maybe fling. But ultimately, it's the quality and the character of her that I always loved and respected. And I've been with Sue because I met her, in fact, the first night I played Wembley in 1973. She came to my suite along because she was signed to Bell Records as an artist. And we met, we became friends. We kept in touch, and then she got married, and I got married, and we didn't see each other for 13 years. And then I got a message through an attorney that Sue Schifrin had called me, and this was in L.A. in 1986. And I had gotten divorced, and she had gotten divorced, and took her to dinner. We've been together ever since.
I'm just a tambourine man, a lonely one-man band. So many people near me, won't someone stop and hear me speak that shine bright? You are my only spotlight. Oh, they won't make you happy. When I sing, I'll make you happy. Won't you let me sing my songs for you?
I look at somebody like Michael Jackson. How have you survived? Because you've had your skirmishes with alcohol.
All of it.
You know.
All of it.
How have you managed to...
I've managed to because there's a certain self-respect and love for myself. And knowing that there are other people who love and care for me that would hurt them. My son, my wife, you know, my friends, my brothers, my fans.
Of course, back in the old days, your great rival... was Donny Osmond. Not as far as you were concerned, but
no.
As the fans were concerned.
Fans here were.
Yeah. Have you met him? Have you?
Yeah,
met,
sure. I had dinner with him a few years ago in L.A. Just, you know, he's followed a lot of the things I've done. I followed some things he's done. And meaning, I did a show called Little Johnny Jones in the theater. I left it after 6 months. He took it to Broadway, and unfortunately, they crucified the show and him. There have been a few other projects that I had done, and he came and did it. I did Joseph on Broadway.
And he did Joseph.
And he later did Joseph, although not on Broadway ever. He did the road company of
it. The touring version.
Right, but I had done it originally on Broadway in the original production. His production much different, but he did it for years and years. So there have been a lot of parallels, you know.
Would you ever share a stage with him?
Sure. I shared it with the Osmond brothers and love them. And really, I think it's little girls... growing up, having a rivalry, going, I'm a fan of Manchester City, I'm a fan of Manchester United. So you're either one or the other. I'm either a Donnie fan or a David fan or an Osmond fan or a David Cassidy Partridge Family. You know, it was that kind of thing. And I think it's mostly, it was a fans rivalry, which I think became so, I don't know, magnified here somehow. For me, it's about the work, and I've had so much other successes in my life, and having a successful relationship. If you're talking about fame, you can never be famous for the first time again. You can never be 21 again. So I can never be the biggest pop star, biggest teen idol in the world again. I've already done that.
But are you glad you've done that? Are you glad you had that experience?
Of course I am. Are you kidding? I wouldn't be talking to you. We wouldn't be doing this if I hadn't had that experience. If I didn't have people who love me and have been fans of mine, and I've been so grateful to have them, I wouldn't have touched their lives. I can't imagine what my life would have been. That's another reality that I'll never know. But this is the only... I live in this moment. I am flawed as everyone else is. And I try and be as honest and as genuine as I can be all the time.
Well, David, let's celebrate 40 years. And thank you for all that you've done.
Thank you.
How can I show it's constantly changing? How can I be sure where I stand with you?
Production for BBC Radio 2. This is BBC Radio 2.